Welcome once again to Everyday Holiness, a Faith Indie podcast brought to you by the Notre Dame Alumni Association. This is again your host, Dan Allen, Associate Director of Spirituality and Service, and we're glad to have you with us. I'm very glad to be joined this week by Father Bill Leese, who is a Holy Cross priest. He graduated with his Master's of Divinity from Notre Dame in 1993, and he's currently the Provincial Superior for the United States Province of Priests and Brothers. So, Father Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you and hear a lot of your perspective on what you do with the congregation. But we'll start more on a personal side. Where are you from originally? And as you think about your upbringing, what are some key moments that you remember?
Sure. I want to say first that when I got your email regarding the invitation to the Holiness podcast, I thought to myself, are you sure this is for me? I'm from Minnesota, Little Falls, Minnesota. It's a little town in the middle of the state. It's the boyhood home of Charles Lindbergh and me.
Yes. You're right next to him on the sign.
That's right. And my nine siblings. So I'm the ninth of 10 kids. Dad was a school teacher at our St. Mary's grade school, where we all went to school. And mom was a nurse at St. Gabriel's Hospital, the Franciscan Hospital in town. It's just 7,500 people. So it was a great place to grow up. And almost all my siblings are still there. So I get back there as often as I can.
And your brother is a twin. So what were some dynamics of growing up with a twin brother and being one of 10?
Well, it's interesting. So the first nine kids came in 10 years. So mom and dad were busy. My mom didn't actually know she was having twins. They were leaving the delivery room after gym. Well, she was pretty certain she was, but the doctor insisted she wasn't. So they're leaving the delivery room. And somebody yells, wait a minute, I think we've got another one here. And my mom starts screaming, no, no. And I told the story at a party we threw for her years later. And she said, Bill, I hardly think I was that emphatic. And I said, Mom, that was my welcome into the world. People say, did you try to fool people? Were you like the regalones, the spoiled ones and stuff? None of that was the case, because the truth is, Jim and I became really close friends because he and I and our brother Mike, who was a year older than us, were defending ourselves from the onslaught from above, right? So we had a really fun, close-knit family, always outside, always running around. We actually grew up on a 50-acre farm just south of Little Falls. So mom bought this in the late 50s. I was born in 62. And they actually, on the property, it's on the Mississippi River, 50 acres, they, instead of farming, they planted 40,000 Norway pines and just raised kids. So it was really a great place to grow up. We had two basketball teams, one baseball team. It worked out great all the way around. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. And Jim and I had a great time growing up. But then we have one little sister, Sue, who came along later.
And as you think about your own faith formation and important moments of faith when you were a kid, what are some things that come to mind there?
Our dad died very young. He was 42 and he died of a heart attack. So this is when my mother was pregnant with my little sister at 3 months. So the oldest was 14. So there were 10 of us. And mom took on the entire, responsibility. It just happened that none of her family was around. She grew up in Racine, Wisconsin. Her family's kind of scattered from there, but not to Minnesota. And dad was from a small family. So none of our aunts and uncles or cousins were around. But mom was just a rock. She was amazing. So it's funny. She was, so we have seven boys, three girls. She was supposed to be named Margaret. Her oldest sister is a Franciscan sister. The next is a Palatine priest. The next is an Irish Christian brother. Mom had her 10 kids as though to make up for it. And then there's a bachelor uncle and four more who had families. But she was supposed to be named Margaret. But she was born on Good Friday, in April. And so instead of naming her Margaret, her dear, beautiful German parents, very Catholic, named her Dolores, after Our Lady of Seven Sorrows, right? And so she was Dolores. They called her Lori. Everyone called her Lori. But my six brothers and I spent the rest of our lives trying to convince her that her seven boys were not her seven sorrows, that it was just a coincidence. But she became, when you ask about virtue and models of holiness, there is no doubt in my mind that my mother was all that for all of us. She was a patient, loving, never raised her voice, just so amazing. And believe me, I have a few brothers who got into a lot of trouble, a lot more than I did. And I'm just amazed how she endured it. But if you'd asked her then, you know, like, and I heard her being asked this, like, Lori, how did you do it? She'd say, I just trusted that the Lord would see us through, and he did. And you felt that, even if she hadn't said it. You just felt like she was a woman of strong faith and just had to depend on our God in a way that most of us, it's not required.
Yeah, it's unimaginable, really, to think about that many kids and that much responsibility, and then not only her own loss and tragedy of losing her husband, but then trying to help you, all of you kids. You know, some of you very young, not even getting to really to know your dad that well. So in the midst of all that and in your upbringing, did you think about priesthood during that time, or what were, as you thought about your own vocation and, you know, not having your dad as a physical part of your life and seeing your mom really bear these sufferings and these sorrows so well, what was your thoughts on priesthood during your young years?
You know, we were a very faithful family. I mean, Sundays, it would have been, you know, and when dad was alive, they used to go in two different crews, right? So somebody would be at home with the kids when the other was at mass. Mm. And as I said, mom's older siblings were all religious. Mm. So the idea of religious life, I'd be surprised if it didn't run through the minds of each of my siblings at one time or another. So there was something really natural about it. I mean, we didn't understand the complexities of it or the vows per se, things like that. But boy, we loved these religious. They were, you know, it was post-Vatican II. I was born in 62, so right during the council. And they were just loving, beautiful folks, very talented. My aunt was in the music department at El Verno. She was a school sister of St. Francis from Milwaukee at El Verno College for years. My uncle, Brother Norbert, was the founding principal at Brother Rice in Bloomfield Hills. And Uncle Fritz, Father Francis, was a teacher in high school in Milwaukee. So just servant people. So they were great role models for us. Yeah, and I think it just, I don't recall it being a very serious thought when you're in grade school. At least I don't recall. But in high school, both Jim and I talked about it quite a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I went off to St. John's University in Collegeville, and Jim went off to St. Thomas and St. Paul. And these were, that was sort of an unspoken agreement. I think we were tired of being lumped together as much as we were. And so, and we sort of wanted our own friends and things. So that worked out great.
Yeah.
But I thought about it, talked about it less anyway, when I was in college. It was really after college that it kind of emerged again.
And obviously you had these aunts and uncles with different experiences in religious orders. What was your first interaction with the Congregation of Holy Cross? How did that come about?
Well, that's all thanks to Jim Leese, my twin brother. The irony of wanting to go to different colleges is that we ended up in the same religious congregation forever and ever. So Jim spent a year at St. Norbert College working in residence life. We graduated in 84 from undergrad. And he spent a year there. And then he came to Notre Dame for graduate school. He was an assistant rector in Holy Cross Hall with Father Pat Sullivan at the time. And I had occasion to come and visit him a couple times, of course. I was actually in Chicago as a lay volunteer my first year out. And then I worked at a small college in Iowa, Loras College in Dubuque, for 2 years. And it was during that time that I came to see Jim. And in doing so, you know, I got to know some of his friends, several of whom were Holy Cross seminarians. And so it became a natural thing when I was finished at Loras and thinking about religious life and priesthood to come here and at least check out Moreau Seminary. And so that's how I got tied up is I'm like, that sounds like a sentence. No, that's where I got connected with Holy Cross. I remember coming to a visitation weekend at Moreau Seminary when I was thinking seriously about priesthood, and with six older brothers and three sisters, I went to Moreau Seminary. It felt like home, right?
Sure.
We were pounding on each other in basketball. We were running around the lakes and, you know, going off to class or whatever. And it just, I was amazed. So it was pretty much when I was really getting serious about religious life, it was pretty much an immediate sort of, yeah, this is it.
Okay. And where was Jim at the time in his own discernment? Did he follow you? Or
no, he came in 4 years later, probably had the idea before I did. I knew we were talking about it all these years. What happened is Jim, as part of his, he ended up being on campus for an internship in his second year at Notre Dame. And then I came right after he left. He went to London and worked as the rector of the Notre Dame London program because he's no fool. So he was there for 3 years. And then he got a job as the on semester at sea. So he traveled around the world with the University of Pittsburgh semester at sea program. So it was, I mean, shoot, I'd have come in 4 years later if I'd had that.
Yeah, sounds some great, so, yeah, some great experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny too, because Jim said, well, you know, I may never have a chance to travel again. And even as we speak, he's in Australia doing a review for the Australian Catholic University. So, and he works for the Nanavik Institute for European Studies. So he's traveling.
He's got plenty of, got the travel bug continually. So as you progress through formation here, the novitiate, the Masters of Divinity program, what were some important moments during that time where you received maybe some confirmation that, yes, this felt like home, this felt like family, and this is where God is calling me to be?
You know, there were a couple of moments. The easier moments to identify are the ones where you were pretty sure you were wrong about it.
Well, I didn't want to assume and start there, but you can feel free to tell us about those too.
It was in the middle of my postulancy, and I was like, yeah, I can't do this. And I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it sort of faded. And I thought, no, I need to at least, you know, see this through at least the year of postulancy. My gosh. And then I went to the novitiate. The novitiate is a one-year monastic year, essentially, where you study the vows, you know, pray the office as religious, and you live in a very quiet, discerning, lovely community. Our novitiate is in Colorado Springs. I actually just got home from there 2 days ago. I made a provincial visit to see our novices and the staff. But it's in a beautiful place. And a similar thing happened to me in the middle of the novitiate year where I was like, nah, I can't do this. And I remember Frank Quinlivan, who passed away recently, just a beautiful man, was our novice director. And he said, Bill, before you make a decision like this, I think I want you to go away for a few days. And so I went to a hermitage in the woods that the Benedictines had. And I had the most sort of life-giving, powerful renewal of my vocation there. I remember the spiritual director I had, she told me to read a passage of scripture and just stay with it and then write down whatever comes out. And it was the passage, you know, I'm standing at your door knocking, if you would but let me in, I would come in and dine with you. I'm not even sure why I chose that, but I think it's because, you know, for our family, for so many, breaking bread is where so many interactions happen.
Sure.
All that came out of me was a deep and abiding love I felt from Christ. And it was just, it was really powerful. It was like, you're fine. You're going to be fine. You got to relax. But it was sort of overwhelming, and I was really grateful. Went back to the novitiate and had a much lighter step, much lighter heart. And I remember about a week later, one of my novice mates said, "Bill, what happened to you? You seem, you know, something. It seems like there's light behind your eyes." I said, "I'm not sure, but it's not bad. I'll tell you." Yeah. So. Those were both struggle moments, but also those moments where, you know, there was some new light and new confirmation. So, yeah, it was good.
And it seems like every discernment story, every vocational search has those kinds of barriers. And then oftentimes when you hear people getting beyond them, then they can sort of run forth and really dig into living the life. So as you came back to Notre Dame and started to take temporary vows and think about final vows, was that the case for you? Were you really flourishing in life in Holy Cross as you approach final vows and ordination?
You know, Dan, what you describe, I think is true, but I think it's true for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. We all hit these patches in our life where there's a desert or a dark night, and it pushes us deeper to figure out what is the Lord really calling me to? I know you and Stephanie, everyone, we all have these moments where we're drawn deeper to the Christ. And I felt mostly affirmed throughout seminary training. We do our MDiv at the University of Notre Dame. We live at Moreau Seminary. Wonderful community life there. Yeah, I dare say it was really fun. We had a great time. One of the things that I did, which was different than a lot of folks, is after a year and a half, I asked to go to Chile for a regency year, we called them. Now they're called pastoral years. And so I went there for a year and a half, for three semesters. And that was a really amazing experience. Now, it was rough. I lived with 11 Chilean and Peruvian seminarians,
okay,
who didn't speak English, and one gringo priest who wouldn't. So it was an isolating experience. Mm-hmm. Gratefully, there were some Holy Cross associates down the road. My spiritual director was over at St. George's. He was an American Holy Cross priest. So just an amazing experience of walking with people and the poor. And that was both challenging and affirming. It's funny, I finished my time there and I was flying home and I still felt like I was the worst Spanish speaker in the history of the world. And I got home to Minnesota for a little break and it took me about 2 days and I realized, oh my God, I'm the best Spanish speaker within 500 miles of here. So that's been a great gift. Not only did it lead me ultimately to choose to study Latin American politics, but having Spanish for my pastoral ministry has mm-hmm. been just an absolute grace. And mm-hmm. I enjoyed it a lot. So, but then, you know, the rest of formation went well. I remember right before final vows being very nervous. Mm-hmm. I remember I was thinking, Lord, you've made the universe. You think you could hand me a little note to tell me what to do?
Little confirmation
yeah,
here.
Yeah, exactly. But it worked out. I remember shortly after the vows, there was just such this wave of peace and life. And I was like, oh, thank you, Lord. I didn't suspect that it was going to go awry, but I was sure glad it did.
Yeah.
So, no, I would say seminary was a really lovely time.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And you get to the point of ordination. I want to return to your mom for a second because of all that she had been through. What was ordination like for your wider family and seeing really an infusion, I imagine, of God's grace into your family life and what you were taking on that day?
I remember telling Mom about thinking about the seminary, and I was all excited because I was thinking, she's going to love this. Okay. She's going to eat this up.
Right, yeah.
And we were driving somewhere. We were driving to see my brother up in Brainerd, about 30 minutes away, and I was like, Mom, you know, this is what I'm thinking about doing. And instead of like, oh, I'm so glad, she said, no, Bill, have you thought about this? Have you thought about, you know, the vows? Is this something you really, you know? And I'm like, Mom, leave me alone. what I realized later is she was close to her siblings. And I know she was especially close to Uncle Fritz, Father Francis Hiller. And I'm sure that in his moments of loneliness and stuff, they were on the phone. And she was aware of, you know, this isn't the easiest choice. And right. So she was more realistic about what I was doing than certainly I was. I remember, too, she'd say things like, I hope you're not doing this for me. I'm like, don't, Mom, don't kid yourself. My siblings went anywhere from I am the proudest sibling ever mm-hmm. to what are you thinking? But that was all right. By the time vows came, final vows, Jim was already in the congregation, right? He was 4 years behind me, but he came in, I think, when I was in Chile. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up doing his seminary in Berkeley. So we never actually lived in formation together at all. But I remember there were 10 of us ordained, or 13 of us finally professed, and then 10 were ordained. So in August is final profession. That's really like the wedding date,
right,
if you will. And then ordination is sort of your apostolic call, you know, what you'll be doing.
Sure.
It was amazing. The final vows was terrific. You know, all 9 of my siblings were there and their families. And I sense they were delighted. They were happy because they knew I was happy, right? I do remember at Jim's ordination or final vows, one of the two, a woman, I overheard mom say this, a woman came up to her and said, "Oh, you must be so proud of those two boys, you know." And she said, "I'm proud of all my kids." I'm like, "Thanks a lot, Mom."
Yeah.
No, but it's really true. She was, my mother, one of her great virtues was just love. And she loved everybody equally. I remember, so Jim was finishing his doctorate. This was some years later. I was on the phone and we were both really excited because this is not an easy thing. I had finished mine a few years earlier. And so we're getting excited. And I say to her teasingly, because she would hate this, "Ah, Mom, Jim's your favorite." And she looked at me and she was on the phone and she says, "Oh, no, he's not. But neither are you." So she, yeah. So while Mom was proud of us, she was very balanced. And,
yes.
You know, so yeah. It was sweet.
That's good. So you had this experience in Latin America. You then decided to pursue doctoral studies in Latin American politics. Talk about that a little bit, if you would, please, and then where that led you in your young sort of academic career.
Yeah. So wisely, the congregation, typically, if somebody is interested in higher studies, they're usually assigned to a parish first to cut their teeth and be invited to be a priest that the people need, right? So I was assigned to St. Clement's Parish in Hayward, California, which is in Northern California, about 15 minutes south of Oakland, right next to Moreau Catholic High School, one of the brothers' high schools. It was sort of middle, lower middle class area, Latino, Filipino, and Anglo and other, very diverse, very lovely. I just ate it up, had a, you know, K-8 grade school. I do really feel like that's where you're invited to be a priest, right? Mm-hmm. That's where you know what it means to accompany people in moments of sorrow or joy, sacramental moments, all of it. So I was grateful to be there. And then in my time there, then I started thinking about grad school. And so ultimately, yes, I decided so I studied English as an undergrad with minors in French and philosophy. So I always thought I was going to be an English professor because I loved, you know, to read and I loved the classics. Well, by the time I got to Chile, I was there right after the switch from the dictator Pinochet to Patricio Aylwin, the first democratically elected leader in 17 years. And the dynamism of politics impacted society and the poor and the church all became really fascinating to me. So when it came time to choose what to study, I ended up in political science, focusing on Latin America, for which I'm really grateful. So I went to the University of Pittsburgh, worked with their Center for Latino Studies, worked under some really good people, and spent some time researching again down in Latin America, Chile and Argentina, and then finished in about 5 years. And it was a really blessed time for me. It wasn't always easy. There's, you know, I mean, people will tell you this. If there's an isolating experience in your life, it's going to be a doctoral
program. Right, and that dissertation and all those things.
Yeah, you end up just really getting, and if you're not careful, you can get into a real hole. But I had some really supportive people. I lived with 13 De La Salle Christian Brothers at Central Catholic, which was not far from campus, and one Holy Cross priest. I never realized what it meant to be a Holy Cross religious as opposed to a brother De La Salle, because we were so different. I mean, it was just amazing. I was like the loudest person by far in the house. It has little to do with Holy Cross and more to do with me, but it was something. But the brothers were so supportive and just good, true men. It was good. One of the things that distinguished my time in Pittsburgh for me was that shortly after I got there, an old Colombian Jesuit who had started this little fledgling Latino Catholic community, literally 30 people going to mass at the Brothers Chapel. And I would fill in once in a while. But in my first year, in the fall of my first year in doctoral studies, he passed away very suddenly. And they asked me to lead that little Catholic community with the lay people who were leading it. And it was very small, no infrastructure, no, you know, religious ed or anything like that, just a Spanish mass. And I said, I'd be glad to. Well, I was there 5 years, but one of those years was down in Latin America. But in those 5 years, that community just kept growing and growing. So we, first thing we did is we moved to a bigger retreat house chapel very close by, and then finally to a parish down the hill. But if I, when I think about what sort of kept me in the game as a doctoral student, was the balance of, you know, my studies, but then being enmeshed in the lives of these folks. It was just so great. Yeah. I'm still very close to some of them today. Some of my closest friends are folks I met in Pittsburgh during those days. So, you know, it's funny how God will find a way. You would have thought, you know, you want to just stay holed up to get it done. But if not for some of the other things that demanded my attention and my heart, it would have been a lot harder.
Yeah. Got to have semblance of balance, especially in a life like that. So after you finished your PhD, I know there's this dynamic of having conversation with your superiors and thinking about what your next ministry assignment was. So what was that for you?
So I was very close to Father Don McNeil. Mm-hmm. Father Don founded the Center for Social Concerns in 1983. He had done his doctoral work at Princeton in pastoral theology, and just a beautiful guy. And he, I remember meeting him like my visitation weekend before I even joined the postulant program, mm-hmm. and being sort of immediately kindred spirits. Mm-hmm. So in my postulant year, I worked as an intern, or that my pastoral placement essentially was at the Center for Social Concerns. Okay. So I'd gotten to know Don, and you know, I suppose in the back of my head there was always a hope that I might end up at the Center for Social Concerns. Mm-hmm. Well, it sort of materialized as I was finishing my doctoral program. Don had started talking about moving on. He was a little past retirement age. I came to Notre Dame, got an appointment in the political science department. And then the next year, the center came open. And that actually was a real crucial decision point. As you said, you know, your life is mediated by others. So at the time, several things were sort of presented to me. I had always hoped to get on a tenure track, but I also had this dear hope that someday I could be involved at the center. And so one of the things that was proposed that I become half-time director of the Center for Social Concerns and then half-time tenure track. So that would put a tenure track position, move it from 6 to 12 years. And I couldn't imagine doing the Center for Social Concerns job half-time. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing that absorbs you, understandably, especially as a new administrator. But with all student and faculty and community involvement, it was hard for me to imagine. So I made the decision with the help of others that I would be a professional specialist and then a full-time director. And so all those years I taught in the political science department, but my primary responsibility for those 10 years I was at the center was to be executive director and to grow the center. And we did a lot of interesting things in that period. Mm-hmm. I was actually just telling somebody today, they said, what was your sort of happiest time in religious life? And it was easy for me to say it was at the Center for Social Concerns. It, mm-hmm. It's sort of where, what is it? My deepest passion met up with the world's greatest need. And so it's sort of what I wanted my apostolic religious life to look like, to be about.
I always have personal connections to the podcast guests, or I don't always tell them explicitly, but I remember coming in my first year at Notre Dame, and there was some sort of activities time or get to, I don't even know what it was, but it was over in DeBartolo Hall, and you were there with the Center for Social Concerns. And I just remember you as this very joyful, dynamic priest, and thinking, well, that's a really interesting person to know. He seems like he's got it together, and they do some really impactful work. And, you know, I had the chance to participate in a few things during my undergraduate time with the Center for Social Concerns, and it made a big difference in my life. So I remember that about you, that you were just such a good fit there. What were some things about the center that, looking back on it, you're really pleased, you know, as a team that you were able to put together?
Yeah, I'm glad you included it as a team. There's no, in my experience, that was a group that saw itself as team. You know, and I'll tell you, social justice people, on the one hand, are the most passionate people in the world, and on the other, can be the most difficult folks to. And it's in part because of that passion. But we really worked hard and worked together. I think if there were a couple of things that I really appreciated is we grew our endowment significantly, and we were able to build with the Institute of Church Life the new Geddes Hall. And that was long overdue. Our building was the old 50s studio of WNDU. And I loved that building, and it was adequate to our needs, but it was clear it wouldn't be for 3 or 4 more days. I mean, it was that tight. And our advisory board and others, they realized that this was a big, this needed more room and it needed to grow. And the Institute for Church Life was up in the library and they needed space. So that raising the money for that and for our endowment stuff was a joy because of how important it was. It was the easiest story to tell in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
In the midst of my time there too, this would be one of the second things I'm grateful for is we moved from center status to institute status. Mm-hmm. There are certain criteria for a center and then other more academic size of endowment, participation of faculty. So we achieved all of that in the midst of my time there and became an institute. And there were, it's interesting, there was a lot of conversation at the time. Are we going to change our name to the Institute for Social Concerns? But we were actually there was some concern that we were losing what Don McNeil had founded. Now, I didn't feel that way at all. I felt like we were right on track and that Don would be super proud of it. But I understood that people liked the Center for Social Concerns name because it put us at the center of this campus and of the student experience at Notre Dame and the community experience, frankly, yeah, with the faculty we're engaging and the community at large. So we stayed with Center. Now, it didn't offer us the recognition that we deserved, but I think at the time we felt like that was okay. I see that change coming at some point. I guess overall, though, my greatest joy was just, you know, I mean, Dan, your story, I really appreciate it. Here we are, you know, 20 plus years later and friends, and it's that sort of thing that really gave me life is the life-changing experience people had there and I had there. So that's been a joy.
Yeah. And yet, of course, there's aspects of ministry and life and vocation where, you know, kind of like Peter and the Transfiguration, like, let's build tents, like, let's stay here, let's hold on to this moment. And yet there comes a time when you're called to something else. So as you were finishing out your time at the Center for Social Concerns, was that a hard transition? And what are some of the details of that story?
So I was up in Minnesota for Christmas. By now it's like January 5th, and I'm packing my car and I get in my car and I get this phone call and it's from Father John Jenkins. And I was like, hey, John. And it's not like every day John would call me. We were friends, but you know, weren't chatty.
How was your Christmas?
Yeah, exactly. So John says, Bill, I've been thinking about something and I want you to lead it. It's an office for an office where somebody gets up every day and thinks about Notre Dame's service to the church, thinks about the bishops and their interaction with us and how we might be able to more effectively accompany them. And an office that tends to the various, you know, the important organizations with which we liaise. I was like, ugh. And I said, well, okay, John, let me think about that. I'll do that. You know, I'll think about it. And so I get back to campus and I'm sweating this a little bit. It was a long 10-hour drive, I'll tell you that. But at the same time, I was really excited about the prospect of it. Although this was in a time when the sex abuse crisis had sort of come up. And the last thing I really wanted to do was put myself in the firing line of people who didn't think Notre Dame was Catholic enough or folks who might be angry about any number of things. And I get their anger. I get their frustration. I just didn't know if I wanted to be the one to have to deal with it. So I said yes, and we were putting things together. And it was probably another month, 6 weeks later. And I'm in the meeting where I'm going to inform my staff that I'm going to be leaving. So now I'm at the center for 9 years and, you know, 8 months. And I'm a little nervous, you know. And I, you know, we weren't like all very tech savvy at the time, but it happened that I had my computer open and I got this email from John, Father John Jenkins. And it said, Bill, I've been thinking about this. And in order for this position to have the heft it needs and things. I'd like to make it a vice president's position. And I thought to myself, okay, Father, now you've hit upon exactly the job I do not want. Right. It was really funny. I was like, so I was already sweating that I had to tell my staff that I was leaving. As it turns out, staff didn't seem that upset. No, they were great. And I, you know, there was some excitement in me. So I was grateful. And I realized, you know, we ultimately called the Office of Mission Engagement and Church Affairs. So my responsibilities were mission engagement. How are we going to deepen the conversation that we have at the University of Notre Dame around issues of faith and life and our mission, Holy Cross Charism, all the rest, and Church Affairs? I was the principal liaison for the university to the Congregation of Holy Cross, to our local bishop and the USCCB and all the bishops, the Vatican. So we created numerous partnerships with the Vatican Library, with the Vatican Museum. Terrific relationships were built. And then the Holy Land. We oversaw the Tantour Ecumenical Institute from my office. I would say that was not the easiest job, but it was a very fruitful time for me. And I'd like to think for the office and for the university, there was a lot of creative things that were coming out of there. Chuck Lamphere, a very dear friend of yours, it was I hired him early on. And he was a terrific help and is in that office still. So I think it's a really important office, and I'm grateful that John saw the importance of such an initiative.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you had some trepidation about some of the controversies that you would have to endure or the conversations you'd have to be a part of. When you got into the actual ministry of it, what were some surprises maybe that came out of it, some fruitful things? And, you know, but also what were some of the difficulties of the very live conversations we have as a church and society and at the university, how those things all flow together?
Well, you can imagine, Dan. So this was in 2012 that I began in that office. The sex abuse crisis is still swirling. I think Catholic universities in Notre Dame, we're trying to figure out how do we welcome our LGBTQ brothers and sisters, and how do we think about gender and, you know, the campus. And it was, so there were a lot of, I think there was a genuine consensus on our campus that we had to be a welcoming environment, and, you know, but you can imagine that, you know, the church's teachings are clear on these things. And we had a lot of folks who were from different places internally, but also outside. So those were difficult conversations, but I think we advanced. I'm proud of the way that we moved things forward with the help of Aaron Hoffman Harding and student affairs at the time, and others with blessed friends and allies, and an important document, I think, for us. And but a number of other, you know, we tried very hard to welcome the Latino bishops, the African-American bishops. I think the Laetari Medal, which was also in that office, gave us an opportunity to uphold really dear and faithful Catholics who were really making a difference in the church and the world. So there were a lot of interesting and wonderful things that were going on over there.
And by that time, you'd been a priest for a number of years, but all of a sudden you were probably interacting more with bishops than you ever had. Did that give you some insight into the challenges of church governance and what bishops have to face, and also your interactions with the Vatican?
Boy, did it ever. Yeah, it can be a struggle, right? I think John Jenkins always, I may not have always agreed with John Jenkins, but I knew Father John had really prayerfully thought through and discerned some of the things he, you know, and that I could defend them. I felt strongly about them. But sometimes other people didn't agree. And as you know, like when he invited Obama, I was not in this office was created after, but there was a lot of opposition to that. So I was very aware when I came into this role, being the liaison to the Catholic bishops in the U.S. was going to be, you know, not all sunshine and roses, right? Sure. It was going to be challenging because they too were divided on whether that was a good idea or not. And so those were things we had to navigate. But it's funny, we've had two of our priests, Father Bill Walk, and Father Pat Neary, both. Bill's a few years younger than me, and Pat's my age.
Yeah, Bill was on the podcast a couple seasons ago.
So. Okay, good. Yeah. So Bishop Bill Walk down in Pensacola, Tallahassee.
Yes.
He was a ordination classmate of mine, mm-hmm. and became a bishop about 6 years ago. And then Pat, just a year ago, became the bishop of all places, St. Cloud, Minnesota, my own home diocese.
Yeah.
So it was just a wonderful time. He actually invited me to do the Vesper, the homily at Vespers the evening before his ordination to the bishopric. But to your question, you know, you asked if I sort of saw how the other half lives, if you will.
Oh, sure.
It's a joy to see these guys being made bishops and the joy with which they do it. But I read, Pat was just finishing a year, and I read some friends sent me it's called Central Minnesota Catholic. It's essentially their diocesan newsletter. Yeah. Pat's writing an article. He said, my goodness, a few years ago, the last people I would want to hang out with were bishops. And now I am one. That sort of identifies some of my feelings. I mean, when you got to know these guys as human beings and even, you know, cardinals and archbishops, we're all doing the best we can. And it was an education for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's something that in the motivations for doing this podcast is to humanize, I think, everybody's story. Sometimes if people are in vocations other than our own, or we see people's sort of social media life versus their real life, I think there is a real commonality in this struggle sometimes for seeking after holiness, trying to discern and understand and follow God's will in one's life. And it is in hearing people's personal stories and getting to know them as people that we start to recognize we might not agree on everything. We may struggle with different things, but in the end, we're doing the best we can to strive after God's will.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
So as you then, you were in that office for a number of years, and then this provincial superior role comes about. Explain to people how that happens, and were you surprised at all at that turn in your life?
Let me try to explain to you. No, I was very surprised. So our congregation, our provinces have chapter meetings. It's 10 days to 2 weeks of meetings once every 3 years. And it's at the chapter that we essentially outline the pastoral plan for the next provincial administration. Give them directions as to where we want to go in higher ed, in our parishes, in our apostolic life, in general, our community life, all of it. And occasionally at those chapters, we have an election for a provincial. When one is elected provincial, he serves for 6 years. And then when that term is complete at that chapter, that person could be elected for a three-year second term, but just three. Nine is the max. Mm-hmm. Unless that person decides not to put his name in nomination. So the process is that the entire province participates in a straw ballot, say in March. It's almost like a student council election. You vote for three people. The first person gets 3 points, the second gets two, and the last gets one. Those are published for the province. I was not the first name on the list in 18 when I was ultimately elected. And then there's a nominating ballot, and then everyone does the same thing, but those ballots go directly to the Superior General in Rome. He tallies those, and then he calls the top vote getters, if you will, and asks if they would be willing to put their name in nomination.
Okay.
When I got that call, I'd actually gotten that call twice before, mm-hmm. So I was nervous that this might be the chapter where something happens. But I'll tell you, Dan, there's no job I wanted less than being provincial superior of the Congregation of Holy Cross, U.S. Yeah. province. And it was born out of fear mostly. I was, you know, you heard what I said about, I don't relish being in the target zone. Yeah. And I felt like that, you know, this would be just one more opportunity. And I just kept thinking, you know, this is not what I got into the priesthood for. Yeah. So I was elected at the 18th chapter. It's a 2/3 vote of the delegate members. There's like 55 delegates at the chapter, representing at the time a province of about 400. Yeah, my heart just sank when I got elected. And but you know, it only took a few months before I realized that my fundamental role was to care for the souls of these few hundred guys who are fundamentally oriented toward building the kingdom of God. How bad can this be? Right. Now, it turns out it's plenty difficult, but it ultimately, that's what it is, right? So it's all grace. I mean, I really do feel like this is a wonderful ministry. If I thought for a minute that this is not what I was ordained for, I realized that God finds a way, right, to put you where he needs you. And so I have really enjoyed being provincial. I don't want you to ask the guys how they've enjoyed having
okay.
me, but I think it's been a blessing and very challenging. Oh, and you know, that notion that I might be in the target zone. What I realized shortly at that same time, 3 months in, I was like, I'm not in the target zone. Nobody even knows what a provincial is. I mean, literally, I'm like, you know, I remember my brother Mike saying, you know, like, so Bill, congratulations. What is that? You know, so he's he's a heavy equipment mechanic. He was like, what is that? It was good and humbling for me to be in this role.
Yeah, I think people, they know bishops, they know cardinals, we know the Pope, they know. But I think when you get into abbot or provincial or some of these things within religious life, unless you're in religious life, you don't always have a grasp of what that is. So how would you describe what a provincial superior does?
Sure. So the provincial is an ordinary. He doesn't have a geographical area like a diocese, but I'm the U.S. province provincial. So I'm over the U.S. and all of Latin America. And until last January, I was over our East Africa, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania. They have rolled off and become their own province. So you can imagine being administering all these places. You spend a lot of your time in communication with district superiors, making sure they're getting what they need. You spend a lot of time on assignments, mm-hmm. right? So you have the provincial and the provincial team, in coordination with the chapter, sets the pastoral agenda. And so it's really the provincial and his team that has to implement that agenda and carry it forward. So that requires a lot of attention to who's going where, what apostolates do we want to make sure we're not, well, we don't want to neglect any, but make sure that they're getting what they need. We do all personnel. So while I'm utterly convicted that our guys are oriented toward the building of the kingdom, some make mistakes and make bad choices. And so some of that can be tough. So we have to deal with all that. I sense, though, that probably the most important thing we do is what is called our provincial visits. So as provincial, I'm required to see every one of our religious every year. Now, obviously, you know, my assistant provincial, the vicar provincial, is Peter Jarrett, and he helps. And then Father Bill Beauchamp is this steward, mm-hmm. also an assistant provincial. And so we're out visiting these folks a lot. And it's essentially a visit. A provincial visit is a 45-minute to hour conversation with every religious. And you're asking them about their health and their spiritual health and their prayer and their community life and their hopes and their heart and, where are you? What are you hoping for? And how's your relationship with God? It's so, you can imagine what a privilege that is.
Sure.
So it's amazing. And it's humbling. It can get tiring. You might, like when we do, say, Corby Hall or Moreau Seminary, where we have a lot of people, you get to about the fifth or sixth person in a day and you're wondering, did I ask you this already? So I feel kind of bad about it. I don't fall asleep though.
That's good. That's good.
Not yet anyway. So the provincial's role is quite busy, but pretty cool too, because you're sort of leading prayer. I do all the funerals. I presided all the funerals, and I presided Holy Thursday and final vows, things like that.
Has it bolstered your priesthood and in religious life to see so many instances of your brothers in all parts of all over, the world in some sense, and living different ministries?
Yes, it has. You know, it's interesting. I have some friends who are at the University of Notre Dame who have traveled with Holy Cross to other parts of the world, to East Africa or Bangladesh. And I overheard one of them say to a colleague, she said, if you think the work that Holy Cross does is impressive in this country, you should see what they're doing in East Africa, Bangladesh or Chile, And that's True. And it is. It's a privilege to travel to these places, to kibbutz with our brothers and sisters and in all kinds of places. You know, just being with our religious, though, it's so humbling. And to see the sort of deeply gifted, holy, sometimes flawed guys that we have is it almost makes me, well, it does. It makes me feel more at home, more able to love them and be loved. So it's good.
Yeah. And I think, holiness is a topic, obviously, of the podcast. And I always think a realistic look at holiness is an admission that we're not there. We're not saints yet. We're not perfect. But we look to each other to build each other up in seeking after holiness. So who have been some of your heroes and models of holiness who have helped you in your own religious life and your priesthood over the years?
I think it's easy to say Don McNeil. Mm-hmm. I mentioned him earlier. He was so tenacious in his love for the poor and his desire to educate and deepen students' experience and walk with Christ through the poor, and through their research and through their travels. Don was just a blessed soul who was a blessing to me. I'd say my brother Jim has been a great patient companion on this road. I find that identical twins either get along really well or not at all. And I'm just so grateful that we're kindred spirits and really support each other. I think in the end, it'd probably be my mother. You know, you can't tell that story about her life without people assuming that. And it's true. You know, my mother was a kingdom builder, right? She really wanted to heal relationships. I remember, when my dad died, he came home from St. Mary's and said, "Lori, I have this weird pain." And she said, I don't like the sounds of that, Tom. She was an ER nurse. No, she wasn't working. You know, she was working at home, obviously. So dad went over to the hospital and doctor checked him out. He said, "Yeah, Tom, I think you're fine, but let's run some tests tomorrow." So they ran tests the whole next day. It was a Friday then. He said, "Yeah, we didn't find anything. We're good. But why don't you just stay here an extra night to give him a little reprieve from his rotten kids." But he died by himself in that hospital room that night. And my mom, you know, was sad, you know, that she'd been by his side every night of their married life and would have been there as an ER nurse if she had found him in distress or something. But, we navigated that. But the doctor who missed this really took it hard and fell on some really hard personal times just with depression. And he had five kids of his own. They were younger than mom and dad, this couple. But it was really rough. And it got to this point where he couldn't work. And I remember, so mom has Susie, my little sister, 6 months later. And you know what she does? She wraps her up on a cold winter day. And she goes over to the doctor's house to ask him and his wife to be her godparents.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. And it was like, it was as if to say, this isn't you. This is, we're all in this together. You don't need to take this on. So that's the sort of healer and selfless sort of person she was.
Yeah, of course, her name.
Yeah, is that funny?
And your connection, you know, with the Congregation of Holy Cross to Our Lady of Sorrows. It just...
I know, we think about that all the time. What are the chances of having your mother named after Our Lady of Sorrows and then ending up in a religious community whose patronal feast is Our Lady of Sorrows, right? Our Lady of the Seven Dolors. Dolores.
Yeah. So you've had some of these models. You've lived many years as a religious and a priest. What have been some of the things that have worked for you as you've gotten closer to God and sought after holiness?
I have been very grateful for our common prayer, morning and evening prayer, mass together, things like that. Even in our little provincial house, Pete and I there's only two of us in the provincial house, and we are very regular to morning, you know, to mass, everything, you know. And it's just such a boon to the spirit. But I will say it's not where I go to be utterly nourished. I know it's important, but I'm sort of a prayer walker. And so if I'm walking, I'm praying. I also find that, you know, an occasional retreat for someone who's as gregarious and active as I find myself is really important. It's amazing the stuff you get to, even if you take a day away, when you're really letting yourself be open to Christ and to the Word of God. Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't kidding when you said, you know, when you sent that email and said, "Hey, would you consider this?" I was like, "I may not be your guy. I don't consider myself very holy, but I'm desperate to be holy. And of course, I'm holy enough, right? We're all doing the best we can. I know I have a long way to go, but I'm grateful for the patience of the Lord and my brothers, and it's a good thing. I am so happy in this life, Dan. I have once in a while doubted a job I've had, but never doubted my priesthood or my presence in Holy Cross, and all that calls me to be and calls out of me. And I think it's in that communion of our brotherhood that I remain holy and sustained. We had the great joy of ordaining 8 of our guys the Saturday after Easter not long ago. You can imagine what a delight a moment like that is. Yeah. And when you're rejoicing in the resurrection of the Lord and in the church that he's built and the kingdom that you long to build. Mm-hmm. So it's there are moments like that that are really grace-filled.
Yeah. Well, honestly, that's what this is all about. I was a little surprised at your reluctance because I thought a lot of people look up to you. A lot of people see you, obviously, in your own congregation as a leader and a spiritual mentor. So, but it's probably true that, you know, we have to remain humble. We don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves and admit we and God know our flaws very well, and admit that, you know, we're all on the way. So, well, thank you, Father Bill, for accepting reluctantly the invitation. It's been a joy to talk with you and to hear more of your story. And I think for people out there to understand your story and even out of some difficult times early in your life to see what God's grace can do in a willing heart and a life. So thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure being with you. I miss you and your whole family.
Yes, it's good. It's good to see you as well. Well, that concludes this episode of Everyday Holiness, a Faith Indie podcast. As always, we invite you to subscribe to the podcast, to share it with others who might be built up by the stories we share here. And of course, to sign up for our Faith Indie Daily Gospel Reflection at faith.nd.edu/signup. There we share the gospel or reflection every day and episodes of the podcast. Until next time, you'll be in our prayers. God bless you all.